No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I hope my show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. And tonight we have a great guest, Dr. Alex Hinton. He is a distinguished professor of anthropology. He's director of the Center for Study on Genocide and Human Rights and a UNESCO chair in genocide prevention at Rutgers University. He's written too many books for me to tell you about. He's written 17 books, but the one that I think we're going to talk about today is It Can Happen Here: White Power and the Rising Threat of Genocide in the U.S., which is was published by NYU in 2021. And he's written another one called Perpetrators: Encountering Humanity's Dark Side, which I think has been on display lately. And that's what we want to talk to him about today. Dr. Hinton, thanks so much for being on our show.
Yeah, thanks, Senator Brown. I really appreciate the invite.
Yeah, and let me ask you, first of all, I see that you've received an award for excellence in anticipatory anthropology. Can you explain to us social science students that unfortunately didn't take enough anthropology what anticipatory anthropology is?
That's a good question. Other people have asked that as well. It's a great question. So this was actually done by, a professor, Texter, a number of years ago. Unfortunately, he's passed. And back then, it was even more sort of unusual. There's actually now a sort of field called future studies that's kind of emerged in different disciplines in academia. But to sort of cut to the chase, so one thing in the world of genocide prevention that we work on is risk assessment. So you try and look at causal factors that lead to genocide and mass violence. And that's a sort of future-oriented endeavor that looks at possible scenarios, what might go wrong. And so that's an example of, anticipatory. It's looking at the future. You can look at climate change, anything that's directed towards future possible outcomes. The ones I look at are negative outcomes.
Well, I mean, this begs the question that I'm almost afraid to ask. What's your risk assessment of the U.S. right now? What direction are we headed in? I assume it's not a positive direction.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's sort of the question, and I actually am going to probably be doing a little bit of writing on this coming up. So we had already been doing that, looking towards the election, and especially with regard to the threat of election-related violence. And really, everybody was kind of trained on that because the assumption was, from going to a lot of MAGA rallies to do research, I was pretty sure Trump was going to win. I didn't expect it to be a landslide. I think there weren't many people who did. So everyone was sort of assuming we'd be in a contested phase. And when you get into that, you're in dicey territory. I guess in the end, if there had to be a loss or a victory, having one that was clear cut in either direction, the one benefit, regardless of where you stand, is I think there would have been, election-related violence that would have taken place, not necessarily on a large scale, but certainly on a smaller scale. And we would have had contestation, valid voter, protests about different voting blocks, so on and so forth. But here we are, and now we can wait four more years till we circle back to it.
Well, and can I just put in a plug for the President of the United States today, who reached out his hand to Donald Trump and President-elect Trump and said that there would be a peaceful transition of power. And God bless him for doing that. That's more than the new elected president ever did. And I'm proud to call myself a Democrat today. Thank you, President Biden. But let's, you know, you've written this book, White Power and the Rising Threat of Genocide in the U.S. Can we talk about that a little bit? Explain that book to us and, you know, what your thesis was and you know, what you found out. I'm almost afraid to know, but I think it's important for us, right, to discuss this. So, and after you're done explaining the book to us, tell us how people can get it, because I think everybody should read it. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. You know, so the book was written, you know, like a number of people. I have a long history of studying genocide and mass violence. I did my anthropological research in Cambodia, and you mentioned the book Perpetrators. You know, I interviewed different sorts of perpetrators, torturers, all sorts of things way back when over the years. And then I sort of worked on what's called transitional justice, sort of an academic practitioner term, but it's basically looking at things like truth commissions, international tribunals that help a society move forward. And Cambodia has sort of gone through this process. And I was testifying at a international tribunal being held in Cambodia in 2015, around the same time that then candidate Trump was running. And at the time, you know, there were sort of echoes past and present. The number one meme 1 week I remember was Trump is Hitler. That was circulating sort of authoritarianism. So that, you know, I was talking about this. And, you know, I had studied this for a long time, and I thought it would be interesting to bring the insights to bear on the U.S. And then we had Charlottesville, and that kind of catalyzed my decision to write a book. And so the book follows the course from about 2017 into 2020, sort of looking at the U.S. as the risk of violence is increasing. So that it can happen here, like underscores the point that what was taking place in the United States was not an aberration. It may have been in many ways, you know, of note and seemed strange to people, but it was continuous with a long history in the U.S. And so the sort of, you know, genocide part of it is, well, if you look at U.S. history, you know, for example, look at indigenous peoples, Native Americans, you know, obviously genocide took place against multiple indigenous groups. Arguably, genocide took place against the black population in the United States. There was a petition, We Charge Genocide, at one point that was brought forth after the UN Genocide Convention was passed in 1948, sort of making that case. So part of the book looks not just at this, but at the history of the U.S. to say that, you know, the things that are going on now aren't the same, but they have echoes and they emerge out of a long history. And right now, I think the part of the history that I talk about in the book that we see again is nativism, which goes back, for example, to the mid-1800s, when you had waves of immigrants, for example, Irish, who were coming over. You know, people may not know this, but at the time, the Irish were actually considered a different race, and they were viewed as savages, you know, so the notion of race, it shifts over time. Italians were also regarded by some as a different race. And so the immigrants would come over, and there would be this notion of invasion, swarms, and this has bubbled up and, you know, been a continuous thread through U.S. history, and different people picked up on it, Buchanan, now Trump, and it is a very effective way to stir up fear and to get votes. And the difference with former President Trump, now incoming President Trump, is that he, you know, is, for many people, a charismatic leader. He knows how to work a crowd. He has lots of experience in entertainment, and he runs a show. And he knows how to play to the audience, and he's been very effective in the messaging of the Trump campaign. As a campaign, was extremely effective. But at its root, you know, there's sort of the two things, the meat and potatoes. were immigration and the economy, in particular inflation, which really was an albatross that, even if it has come down, was around the neck of the Democrats.
Yeah, I mean, for people that don't remember, I certainly remember, even though I wasn't there, because my grandmother came over in the early 1900s, my maternal grandmother from Italy. She was blonde hair and blue-eyed, so she didn't. She passed as an American. She always called herself an American. My little Italian grandfather, who wasn't very educated, spoke four languages. English was not his best, and my grandmother wouldn't even speak Italian to him. She would say, "Speak Amazing. English. I'm American." And we weren't allowed to speak Italian in our house. None of us learned it. My mother and her sisters kind of understood it. When my grandmother got mad, they understood what she was saying in Italian. But otherwise, none of us could speak it. And my grandmother would absolutely not speak it to you unless she was convinced that you understood no other language. Yeah, it was all about my mother changed her name. Now, my mother would have been, if she were alive today, about 110 years old, 112 years old. But she changed her name when she went to go get her first jobs. Her last name was Carissimi, a very Italian name. And so she changed her name. All the children were given American names. There were no Giancomos or Marias, or everybody was like Louise and Sally and Joanne. So, it was very, very prominent. And I think people forget that. So let's hope, you know, you studied Cambodia. Let's hope we haven't elected a Pol Pot, huh? But what do you think about the man we just elected? Do you see any similarities between, and what are they between the Hitlers, Mussolini's, Pol Pot's, you know, people like that in the world?
Yeah, those are big, big questions. You know, I think one differentiation, you know, I'm kind of wary of the phrasing of saying, you know, Trump is a fascist, Trump is a Hitler. What that language does, and it's something that commonly happens, is it takes complex phenomena and kind of reduce them down into, it's like school shootings, mass shootings, person's crazy. Yeah. And it directs away from structural factors, even the, you know, saying, oh, this person is a racist, directs away from issues like structural racism. You know, but if you, you know, so in terms of, you know, and I sort of have a view of looking ahead, some of the dangers that we potentially face. But if you're just talking about like a differentiation, one thing is, if you look at Hitler, if you look at Pol Pot, if you look at Mao, if you look at Stalin, these were heavily, right, extremely ideological people where they had an agenda that was driven by an ideology. So it's not to say that there is an ideology that infuses you know, some sectors of the Republican Party. But I don't think that Trump is at all an ideologue. You maybe could characterize him, more as a demagogue. But that ideological element isn't there. So, you know, the book, I should have finished saying that, you know, like the genocide is the far end of the spectrum, and it actually looks at the word it could be a number of things. It could talk about a move of democratic backsliding, which did take place during the first Trump administration, and it's certainly a danger to take place in the second Trump administration. Now, I've always thought that the sort of endpoint of danger has nothing to do with, like, you know, fascism, something like that. It's more of the Viktor Orban model, and I don't know if people are unfamiliar with him. He's the leader of Hungary, and what he did is he began over a long period of time. This happened in Poland as well. To whittle away at the media, at the independence of the judiciary, and eventually, you know, establish what's sort of a soft authoritarianism, or certainly, you know, an extreme case of democratic backsliding. There's still elections, but Orban controls the levers of power. And that would be a worst-case scenario. I actually think the at this point, one difference from the first time is that there's much more of a center. The sort of shifts in voting were somewhat astounding, you know, like the majority of Latino men voting for Trump. And so there's, you know, the hopeful scenario is that there's now a sort of center that's going to be, you know, that needs to be addressed with the people in the Trump administration. So that would be looking forward at a better scenario, but whatever happens, you know, everyone needs to keep their eye on the next transition of power because there are all sorts of scenarios. Like, what if Laura Trump is running? Right. I haven't heard anyone talk about that, but what if she becomes a senator? Rubio's gone. These different sorts of things run, and, you know, the Democrats, because the Democrats are going to be in a much better position in 4 years. Trump's going to be ending. You won't have the inflation argument. You're going to have all sorts of other issues, things that went wrong during the Trump administration. Democrats are going to have 4 years to plan, get the message straight, because, you know, I talked to lots of people, as I'm sure you did and everyone did, and people, no message. There's no MAGA of the Democrats, for example, which is a crystal clear message that they hung everything on. And even if it seems simplistic to people, it was very effective. So Democrats are going to be well positioned in 4 years, I think. So what happens we're back to the transition of power issue, and we're right back to the threat of violence in the U.S. at that point.
Yeah, can we talk about, I think you're right about that, and I see an opportunity in the work that we do here in Washington trying to get a vote for the people of the District of Columbia. I look at the civil rights movement in the South, and I realized that, you know, it was when people saw water cannons being turned on college students and things like that, that the country got involved. And my hope is here that there's an opportunity for us to make a case for the people of D.C. who are about to get the hell kicked out of them by the new administration. I don't know if that'll help us or not, but I think you're right that the Democrats will be in a much better position in 4 years. But can we talk about gun violence in schools? Is that something you've taken a look at? Because I got to tell you, Dr. Hinton, when I was a kid, we had one mass shooting that I remember, some guy in a bell tower in a college in Texas. We didn't have mass shootings every day, which we have today. What is it that's so much different? I know that we worry about the spread of guns, but it's got to be more than that, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I also look in terms of mass shootings at sort of far-right extremist mass shootings. Mm-hmm. And there's a little bit of the connection point. I think is social media and the internet, the flow of information, the way people can connect, the way that everything's immediately seen. You know, none of this existed when I was growing up, a completely different reality. You had no idea. You could watch the news at night, but you had no idea really what was taking place in other parts of the country, let alone the world. And now things are transmitted in a blink of an eye. So if you look at the Buffalo shooter, right, he was radicalized online by looking at videos that the Christchurch shooter had put on. And, you know, this was during the pandemic, and he got into guns, and, you know, he was radicalized online. So school shooters, sort of it's the same thing. You see these images cycling around. You can get a degree of fame. And then we sort of move into as well, sort of a psychological level of analysis about human beings. What do they do when their life has a void? Maybe so there are shooters that have certainly mental illness problems. So that's moving it down to the individual level, but on the sort of more systemic macro level, looking at things like the internet. And of course, I mean, I guess the obvious thing was so obvious to talk about is that, you know, the U.S. is awash in guns. And sort of going back to your point about, getting representation. I know that's a little aside from what we were talking about, but it's kind of incredible. There's no representation.
Yeah, there is. It's incredible.
I think many people don't know that, actually.
Yeah. Well, the purpose of this podcast was to begin. That's what started this podcast 11 years ago, is to try to get the word out about it. That's why we do the little blurb at the beginning of the show, even though we talk about so many different issues, so we can let people know. But is there a psychological, is there some connection you can make between these guys, between these people that do these massive shootings, from a psychological standpoint, that connects them somehow? I mean, I was radicalized in college. I went out and marched against the Vietnam War. But it turned, what I did to deal with it is I ran for public office. You know, I never thought about getting a gun and wiping out a bunch of people over it, especially people that are not connected, right? I mean, you can see that maybe somebody who tries to assassinate a politician or comes out against a group of people that they've been radicalized against, like on these unfortunate things we've seen in Amsterdam lately. That's one thing. But if you're radicalized, why would you go into a school? Is there any sense of connection there? Why would you go into a school and kill school children?
Yeah, well, I mean, one thing is there's no sort of singular answer, and, you know, you have different people who do for different reasons. If we're talking about this, people who are students, remember, that's their world.
Yeah.
Like, they're not out exploring and sort of moving on and looking at other things. When you're in high school, that's everything, you know? That's kind of the circuit you're in, but now we've got, they can bridge into these sort of dark web spaces as well. Yeah, you know, that's... Anyways, that's I think it's important to think about that, and you know, everyone can go back and think about high school, and you know, your status concerns are heightened if something happens to you, you're humiliated. Right. I was recently at the Eradicate Hate Summit, and there was the mother of a shooter. This was at the university level, sort of told the story of her son and what happened to him, and he would be sort of like leaning towards what we talked about as the manosphere now, incel, resentment against women. But a lot of it began, he was at a party, and he was ridiculed, humiliated, and shamed in front of a bunch of people and a lot of women, and that seemed to be a real catalyst event that turned him inwards. You know, it's not like ever, you know, when people, there's always a poem that I referred to before, it's like easy to say, oh, he's crazy. You know, he's mentally, it's like those things don't explain. They, you know, are things that are convenient containers to probably make us feel better because we don't have to do deep exploration. You know, Tree of Life, if we just say, oh, Robert Bowers was an anti-Semite, well, that may be true, but there's a lot more to, you know, what led him to shoot up Tree of Life, synagogue. So that people work in this space is always something we're kind of having to push up against, is that these words point to something, word evil as well. You know, horrible things, but to understand why people are doing these things. Anyway, so these, you know, so there's no single silver bullet explanation, but certainly a lot of people have studied the stuff, and we know quite a bit about it. But even with the election, you know, the impact of misinformation, of sort of dark web spaces, of the continuity between, you know, like 4chan, domains of Telegram where memes get started and they bubble up. And, you know, the pet-eating Haitians is an example of how something came off the Internet and soon was being talked about on the political level that played into all sorts of problematic, going back to nativism, you know, problematic things when it was raised as an issue.
Well, and how about that as a society? I mean, I think that it's been my perception for a long time, or my opinion for a long time, that people really, when they go on the internet, they're not looking for the truth. They're trying to search out validation for their own prejudices. So is there something we can do at a societal level that mitigates against that? that mitigates against, you know, I hate Jews, so I'm going to go look for other people that hate Jews, right? Or I hate black people, or I hate women, or whatever it is. You can find somebody that agrees. I don't care what your crazy position is. You can find somebody that agrees with you on the internet. So is there something we can do at a societal level to, especially with people like you who are in education, is there something we need to do to educate our young people to keep them from going down these dark rabbit holes, or is that just too far reach?
No, absolutely. You know, and I picked this up a little bit in my book as well, where part of it is set in sort of a first-person narrative in the classroom, and the students are sort of working through this. With after Charlottesville, there's a New York Times reporter who tried to explain, you know, met with one of the participants, Tony Hoveter, and tried to explain what happened, was unable to explain, and it caused a huge controversy at the time. People were saying you're normalizing a Nazi. But he ended the sort of an article he wrote in the New York Times. At the end of it, he raised the question, what makes a man start fires? It's the title of an album. Anyways, I made that the question that my students answered in one of my classes, and they would all pick someone and sort of unpack the different reasons. So, you know, the whole field of genocide and Holocaust education is directed towards exactly this, to sort of, you know, speak to this. You know, recently what I've done in my classes, sometimes there's a philosopher, Adorno, who came to the U.S. He wrote the book The Authoritarian Personality with some other American positivist psychologists. That term also has sort of cycled back again. But he said, you know, he had this essay, it was a radio address actually called Education After Auschwitz. And the idea was that it's not as if genocide exists and is gone. The dynamics that give rise to it are omnipresent. They're around us all the time. It's kind of like a low simmer, if you will. And then the question is sort of when the heat gets turned up. So the potentiality is always bubbling, not just in the U.S., but everywhere, you know, governance structures, what have you. And so his idea was you've got to teach kids to think critically from the start, to unpack, you know, the histories that inform the world in which they live, and also the different economic, social, cultural forces that give rise to their being. And those are often, it's often an uncomfortable thing to do. But to sort of circle back to the point you made, there's this German term, reification. It basically just means thingification. To turn complex things into reified form, into a thing, and that can be people. So you call someone, as you were just talking about, you know, that person's an anti-Semite. But for Adorno, the paradox was that this is how human beings think. In order to navigate incredibly complex worlds, we have to categorize things. And so for him, what needs to be taught and what needs to be understood is that this is a constant tendency. And the easiest thing in the world, as you just made the point, is to label someone something, because that, you know, contains something in an easy manner. That's the tip of the iceberg of sort of the educational, pedagogical stuff that we can use in the classroom to combat this. So, you know, even, you know, I've studied MAGA and Trump voters, and I'm always pushing back against the notion that there's this singular Trump voter or MAGA supporter, and they're all racist. You know, and sort of in this one, the easiest way to say, well, does that mean that the majority of Latino men are racist? And that's probably not going to be the answer. The idea is you need to push, you need to understand the lines of reasoning that give rise to their choices. And that line of understanding as well points away from what I think ultimately, and I'm not a political economist, was the real, you know, there are a couple things, messaging, but, you know, to circle back to it, inflation, no inflation. And I think it would have been a very close election. And, you know, we can all say, well, inflation's way down, but everyone, when they go buy a cup of coffee, they're paying $2 extra for it. You know, they go get eggs, they buy gas. It's something that's concrete. And so I expect the Democrats will have something to run against, but they'll flip also, I think, we're in sort of a different, separate argument, separate discussion back to sort of class, the working class, and that'll be sort of the message that emerges in 4 years.
Well, first of all, Doctor, I think it's something the Democrats have forgotten, that for most people, the economy is about the price of bread and the price of gas. Not everyone has a 401k. I certainly look at the stock market because I collect money from my retirement accounts and they're doing great. But the cost of bread and the cost of gas is really what's important. And, you know, I understand the Latino thing. I got to tell you, I understand it because of my grandmother. My grandmother was an Italian immigrant. She didn't want to see another Italian get into the country, because every time an Italian came into the country, it somehow took something away from her. I don't, you know, something I really didn't understand. She wasn't very well educated, but that was her opinion, you know, and I see that. I can see that Latino men, you know, the most conservative people in a society, right, Doctor, are the wealthiest and poorest because they don't want to see change. It's too scary for both sides. But let me ask you, what about people like union workers? You know, I was a Teamster, the first decent job I ever had. I was orphaned as a kid. And the first decent job I ever had, I lied about my age, and I got a job with a New Jersey firm, and they were all Teamsters. I was driving a truck, and I became a Teamster. And for the first time, I was embarrassed to say that when I saw the head of our union speak at the Republican convention. The Teamsters have never even attended a Republican convention. So that's the thing that I find incredible, that a man who's a billionaire, who's never really worked a day in his life, has convinced working people that he feels their pain. Palestinians voted for this man. Did they forget what he said about them? You know, that he wanted to label them and tag them and keep track of them in America? I mean, I don't understand. Do you have any sense of why people consistently vote against their own self-interest?
Yeah, I think that people don't think it's voting against their self-interest. You know, so there's, again, lots of complicated sort of dynamics that you were just raising. But, you know, so I've gone to multiple Trump rallies. You know, I've been there for research. And he doesn't come across as, you know, this sort of elitist. He speaks to people in a very concrete way. He tells stories. You know, after the really unfortunate garbage comment, you know, he got into that garbage truck. He put on the work. Yeah, he put that on. He did a whole rally with that. You know, I went to a MAGA bus rally. These are kind of rallies of, you know, people are actually now getting positions in the Trump administration, but they're out in the countryside in Pennsylvania, and they pull up, and one of them, you know, I look behind, there's a garbage truck with like Trump written on it. You know, like, this is it. And, you know, it's not just Trump, but their messaging is right on this. They knew exactly what they were doing. You know, like, so for example, when I got to that rally, you have the Make America Great Again. What does that mean exactly? And you had a bunch of signs. They would say on the top in clear cut lettering, Trump, low prices, Harris, high prices. Yep. You know, Trump, safe borders, Harris, open borders. Trump, low taxes, Harris, high taxes. You know, it's just like the messaging was on point over and over again. And, you know, you have a thing for many people don't like what Trump says, but you sort of look, you know, and then the stuff he wants to do is good. And it's going to help me because, look, as we were talking about before, I need to make more money. Things aren't good. I got to put bread on the table. You know, and he's going to fix the economy. And when people think about it, this albatross of inflation, which, you know, coincidentally, leaders all over the world are coming up against this. It is concrete to the point. It's in front of your face. You look back, people don't want to think about the pandemic and stuff that happened. They look back and the economy was booming at the time. You know, we don't, you know, there are lots of other issues that were going on, like who are getting the tax breaks, and, you know, debt building up. People remember it as it's good times, and the Trump campaign pumped that idea up over and over and over again. And there wasn't, you know, a clear-cut message for the Democrats, and they paid the price. You know, people didn't turn out.
Yeah, we have to think about that, right? When people think of the good old days as a pandemic, you really have to adjust your messaging. But let me ask you about. I know that homogeneous populations do a lot better getting along. Being from an Italian family, that's hard for me to understand because we always fought about everything whenever we got together. But is the melting pot in America, does that make a difference that we're not all the same, that we're not the Swedes, that we're not the Dutch, that we're not the Norwegians, we're not Icelanders, we're not people that all come from exactly the same background. Does that add to the friction that you talked about that's constantly there?
I think it does. And democratic focus on very important social justice issues is there, and that's something that the Republicans cast in terms of cultural Marxism, radical left socialism, brainwashing, ideology, which is why, the Democrats aren't going to just abandon social justice, but the pivot to, the working class, which has been forgotten. Class is kind of a forgotten issue for the Democrats, remarkably. So you ask about those union workers. Class is not at the forefront of what the Democrats are talking about. It was a huge mistake. So the other two things, there's one commercial that played, people have now seen it probably, where they sort of end with they, them pronouns, versus quote unquote normal pronouns. That was like a very effective. And I'd go to rallies, and when sort of issues relating to the trans community were brought up, and people would get up and scream. These were like, this was anti-trans things that were being said at the time, which Trump would call trans insanity, and you'd get that in different forms. And then when Harris, this is sort of going down, people made the comment, I wouldn't change anything, So again, Trump, Trump, it's not like Trump did a lot better. It's that Democrats lost tons of voters. People just didn't turn out. Why? Well, you got to have a message.
Yeah, that's true. I think that Kamala Harris did as good a job as she could have done, but she wasn't our first pick. We picked her to be the vice president. We didn't pick her to be president. She was Plan B, right? When I was a superdelegate to the convention, which I have been for many years, and Joe Biden had it in the bag. He had all the delegates. There was no way that anybody else could take the nomination from him, except if he stepped down, which he did 10 weeks before the election. It wasn't enough time to really put together a cohesive message, and maybe we should have understood that, but we found ourselves between a rock and a hard place. Before we go any further, Doctor, let me ask you to tell people how they can get your books, or if you have a website, how they can, because this is generally a call-in show, but we're doing a pre-record here, so people aren't going to be able to call in and ask you questions. So do you have a website?
Yeah, I have a website, but the easiest thing is to go to the, Amazon or to NYU, and it's widely available. I do have like the university website as well, but the easiest way is just to go online, and it's available everywhere.
Okay, well, we'll list the books on our website if anybody's interested, and you can go online and get a copy, and maybe we'll get a better understanding of where we're headed, because this is all very scary territory. And let me ask you, as we're starting to get close to the end of the show, let me ask you about this worldwide phenomenon where we have, is this different than what you've seen in the past, where you have a guy like Trump in India named Modi, and you've got this guy in Argentina, you've got a guy in Brazil, you've got a guy in North Korea, you've got Xi Jinping in China, you've got Is there a realignment here towards, well, if we don't call it fascism, whatever you want to call it, more towards making the world more unstable? Do you think that?
Yeah, this is.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Oh no, I apologize. That's a great question, and I would say we've always. This is sort of the issue, and it's been there from the beginning. You go back to the founding of the United Nations. Everybody shows up. We want to create the United Nations. Well, let's write into the United Nations that we're all going to uphold, the issue. We're going to seek peace. We're going to protect human rights. We're going to protect the innocents. Oh, but by the way, we're also not going to violate sovereignty. And that's always the tension, right? It's sort of the nationalist issue, your country first again. So you mentioned before a number of those different people, like Orban talks about make Europe great again. Yeah. Malay in Argentina is make Argentina great again. Like this is going around that nationalist, nativist, which has that U.S. tradition back to Daniel Boone motif that you mentioned before, and you were talking about the sort of creation of American identity. That's everywhere. And so you have this move through time of sort of, will states give away a bit of their sovereignty for a better world? And this is ongoing. So now a lot of people in the GOP, John Birch Society sort of built this out, look at the UN as a cultural Marxist institution that's out to subvert everything. They want to pull out of the WHO again. They pulled out of UNESCO before, which, again, is viewed as sort of, I've seen at different events, people call it communist. This is a back and forth. So you, in all countries, the ones that you're naming, you have this nationalist card that people play on and then get votes. The flip side is people are now entrenched in a global economy with global issues that they have to deal with. No one country is going to solve the climate issue on their own.
Right.
No one country is going to solve the problem of genocide on their own. No one's going to solve the issue of piracy on their own. It's a global world, and this is sort of the push and pull. But, as I always tell my students who can look at current events that are going on, Israel, Gaza, the West Bank, or Ukraine, and Russia, or the crisis that nobody seems to know about in Sudan, or horrific violence is taking place, or the problems they're having in Haiti. Those things are in our face, and we see them. But if you go back to 1945, and you compare what we have now versus what we have then, the world's in a better place. Even if you look at the threat of nuclear destruction, which has sort of come back again, not to play it down, but, I grew up diving under my desk.
Right, we all did, right?
Yeah, we did.
I remember the drills. The drill from being
Yeah, I even, I'm sometimes ready to jump in or go to an archway of like condition. Kids don't do that. Now we have the school shooter drills, but so that's unfortunate with these kids. But so the optimistic thing is things go back and forth. I think in 4 years it may well be that Democrats, probably even at the midterms, will make a comeback. No one's thinking about the next transition. I haven't heard anyone talk about it, but that's right. What was my first thought. It's like, it's not this transition, it's the next one. So anyways, those of us who watch these things, and write about them, we're going to be looking, already are looking. One thing I would say is that I go back to this thing that there's a bigger center now than there was before. And over time, a lot of the far-right extremist groups have been kind of shut down to an extent. So I don't expect another Charlottesville. So the optimistic reading is that we won't have as much of the tumult as we had before. The pessimistic reading is that we are going to have democratic backsliding. And probably it'll be a mix of the two.
Yeah, well, and we're already seeing it here in D.C. We have a mayor that stood up to Donald Trump on the first his first term and is now talking about reaching common ground. So there is not that I'm against that. I'm all for common ground, but there certainly is going to be backsliding for the Democrats as well as moving forward. Let me ask you, what about students? Since you're a college professor, have you seen a change or what change have you seen in college students, let's say, over the last decade? Are they becoming more conservative, or is there any insight you can give us about the way young people are coming up and thinking these days? Since I'm an old guy, I'm about to have a co-host for a while who's a college student and is just a brilliant college student, with the idea that, you know, we see things differently. You know, I try to consider Al Einstein and everything I do, that what you see depends on where you stand juxtaposed to what you're looking at. So I want to get a young person in here to get their perspective. But do you see a change in the perspective of young people?
Yeah, you know, it's important question, interesting question, complicated question. And like you, I think maybe we can call ourselves generation desk divers, right? We were back in the generation that had to dive under the desk, and it's, you know, no, when I was growing up, no internet, no mobile phones. Right. I remember when the fax machine came along, you know, when AI emerged, my first thought was, oh, remember the calculator? Yeah. Like the calculator came in and all of math skills were going to go away. And that was my first sort of reference, which you probably also share, remembering that moment when that happened, the technological change. But to get to your question, I wanted to make one little point about what people can do. And this has made me think of it again in terms of students. Is, you know, I have my students, the university, the students can get the New York Times for free and then get the Wall Street Journal for free. So I say you should be looking, you know, first of all, to begin at two different perspectives. Every day I get up, or at least at some point during the course of the day, I try and look at CNN, MSNBC, and Fox News. You know, we're all in these informational silos. And these are like small little things you can do to kind of break out of them, because we hear this all the time, but it's absolutely true. And this speaks to your point about the students, is they're in these, they don't get their news from the New York Times in general, right? That's something where I say, well, for the class, we're going to be looking at the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. They get it from their phones. So they're getting Instagram news, right? I mean, they're getting stuff that floats around. So as an educator, as a professor, you know, I'm constantly talking about this. Last night, I was teaching, and people brought up some statistics, and my first comment was, well, that's interesting, but we all need to immediately check that. We want to know the source. We want to assess whether it's good information. So, we're facing in the classroom, we're facing AI, right, with the fabrication of assignments. My own view is that, you know, if you want to pay your tuition dollars and cheat, you're not going to have much of an education, because professors aren't police. But it's a reality. People are using these things. And then I think it'll probably be like the calculator, where it'll just be this tool that's used, and hopefully most people will use it in a good way. But we're not at that point at the moment. But it's like, it's just the internet, the sources, students, and it varies depending on the type of university you're at. In the student body, my university at Rutgers Newark, a lot of students are working. Some have full-time jobs.
Yeah.
That's very different from like an Ivy League institution where they're just there and, you know, they may have work study or something, but most of them don't have to work. They just are studying all the time. So that already means that the amount of reading that a student can do is somewhat diminished if they're, most of them and almost all of them are working. And in general, because of the flow of information, people are used to small chunks of stuff. They're not used to reading books anymore. And so that's a real struggle. Now, the flip side, and this, you know, I hate to keep pulling this generational thing, but we're all walking around with a supercomputer. So you probably remember this. When you would talk to someone, you'd say, hey, you know, X Willie Mays batted 329, and someone would say, no, there's no way. That's not true. It was 312. And you just argue.
I was a guy. Yeah.
And then now you just pull it up on your phone in 2 seconds. Those arguments don't take place anymore. But the point is, I would have to, when I get an article, I'd have to go photocopy an article from a journal, take it to a department, pay 10 cents per, probably it was actually like 5 cents per page back then, take an hour to get one article. Now you get those articles in 15 seconds. I mean, it's astounding. So education, both all sorts of problems and challenges, but also opportunities that exist. But the problems, and I think we have to, in the current generation, can't just say 10 years, we have to think about the pandemic generation. You know, because they were hit hard and went through all sorts of things in a very formative moment. And a lot of them were in areas where, again, if we sort of think about the areas they're coming from, teachers worked very hard, but they didn't have the resources. And so, you know, their education got hit and they're still working through it. So you think about today's generation, maybe towards the sort of point you wanted to get to. You know, we do have things like young white male students. You have both the sort of manosphere part of it. You have a backlash against the sort of social justice. You need to act in certain sorts of ways. White males are to blame. The Joe Rogan audience, if you will. And, you know, that's a, I don't get that so much at my university, but that's another trend line. You know, and, you know, a lot of white males look back to their parents who actually were doing better than they are, and they see their opportunities as diminished. So that was a big hit for, you know, for the Democrats to lose a lot of those voters. But and then Trump won with virtually, you know, outperformed with virtually every single group, even women.
Yeah, no, I get it. Well, and, you know, this is a good place to end, I think, on those remarks. And first, let me say, God bless you for the work you do, because it's important. Also, let me thank you on behalf of Mrs. Brown, who's a school librarian who laments every day the fact that children don't read anymore. I've got three adult children. I don't even think they watch TV anymore. They get everything from their computers or off their phones, like you say. But, yeah, this is a constant battle. My wife's a head librarian at a large high school in Virginia, and it's a constant battle that she has trying to get kids to read. And thank God there are still children out there that love it and do it, and, you know. But I want to thank you so much, Doctor, for being on the show. I hope we'll post your books, and I wish you continued success. And maybe in 4 years we can get together again, and I could say, damn, Doctor, you were right. The Democrats did it. That would be great, wouldn't it?
That'd be fantastic.
Thank you so much for everything you do, and thanks for being on our show.
Well, thanks for your show, and thank you for your work, which is so important. I appreciate it. Your listeners appreciate it, and please keep at it. It's a long fight.
Yeah. I know it is, but my kids say I have job security. So we dedicate a song every at the end of every song we play, every show we play out with a song. And here's one. We send it to you, Doctor, and for everybody in America. It's by a lovely young new artist named Connie Talbot, and it's called Never Give Up on Us. So let's never give up on us, folks. We'll talk to you next week. Thank you, Dr. Hinton.
Thank you.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.